Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Numbers chapter 24, going to do the whole chapter, verses 1 through 25. This chapter covers Balaam's last five oracles. Our context is this. Balaam has been hired by Balak, the king of Moab, and that's where the Israelites are, right there, around Mount Pisgah, east of the Jordan River, at the northern tip of the Dead Sea. They're getting ready to cross over into Jordan, where they've got to figure out how to get past the Moabites, and the Moabites have got to figure out what are they going to do about all these Israelites, because they don't trust them. They think that the Israelites are there to wipe them out, which wasn't true, but that's what they thought. So Balak, the king of Moab, hires Balaam to come down and curse the Israelites. We know the story. Balaam goes down there thinking about it, but God's told him, I'll let you go down there, but you're not going to curse the Israelites. And then Balaam gets stopped by his donkey. If you recall that, the angel of Jehovah, i.e. Jesus, stops Balaam on the way and says, you ain't going to do that. And then makes fun of Balaam by taking over the donkey's vocal cords and making the donkey mock Balaam. So Balaam's got a pretty good respect for God by the time he gets down to Syria. And so the first two oracles he gives at Balak's behest are very pro-Israel and not pro-Moab. Basically, he says, I'm not going to curse Israel. I'm not going to do it. God told me to bless him. I'm going to bless him. And so Balak is all upset. All right, so that's where we are. We start now at Numbers 24, verse 1. When Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, he did not go as at other times to seek omens, but he set his face toward the wilderness. In other words, Balaam stayed right there with the sacrifices. Remember, they had seven altars full of bulls and rams to sacrifice to God to get him to change his mind to curse Israel. The first two oracles, he would make those sacrifices, and then he would go off into the hills to seek God's face and to understand what God wanted to say. But now he just stood there, set his face toward the wilderness. Now, his sorcery on his two previous oracles had been worthless, as we know from the last chapter. Now he simply looks towards the camp of Israel, and the question is why? Here's a couple of options Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown give. Perhaps Balaam had a secret design to curse them after all, despite what God had said. I don't think so. The other option is this. Balaam is just looking out there to await another divine revelation. He's already had two. I don't know why. Maybe there's just no reason why he didn't go back on the hills to get God's answer. He just decided to do it from right there. He didn't go at other times to seek omens. The NIV Study Bible says that means before, in the first two oracles, last chapter, Balaam was using livers and other organs of the dead sacrifices, but now here in this, at the time of the third oracle here, he didn't do that. He just set his face toward the wilderness and forgot using the implements of sorcery. We go now to Numbers 24, verses 2 through 4. And Balaam lifted up his eyes and saw Israel camping tribe by tribe. Now, by the way, I didn't mention this last chapter. Said Balaam was on Mount Peor, which is right there in that northern area of Moab, right north of the tip of the Dead Sea. And so that's where Balaam is as he's looking out, and he saw Israel camping tribe by tribe. And the Spirit of God came upon him. He took up his discourse and said, the oracle of Balaam the son of Beor, and the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God, who sees the vision of the Almighty falling down, yet having his eyes uncovered. Now, Mount Peor, Balaam saw Israel camping tribe by tribe. What that means is they were laid out in martial formation, as described in Numbers 2. We went over that in great detail. They all had to camp according to their tribes in order. Tabernacles right in the middle, if you recall. And so that military formation gave it an awesome appearance, I'm sure. Now, the Spirit of God then comes upon Balaam in verse 2. Now his eyes are fully opened as he prophesies at the beginning of his discourse. This is, by the way, is the third discourse. He says, this is an oracle of the man whose eye is opened, etc., etc. Yeah, he's fully open now. He can see. In fact, he says that in verse 3, and the oracle of the man whose eye is opened. How are his eyes opened? Because the Spirit of God came upon him, the Holy Spirit. Now, this was an unexpected event, as Adam Clark says. I'm sure it was. And it's not a vision. It's not a dream. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that before the regular ministry of the prophets was instituted, God made use of various persons as the instruments through whom he revealed his will, and Balaam was one of these. So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's idea is we don't have regular prophets like Jeremiah and Isaiah and so forth. We don't have those yet. So God is going to use this pagan seer. Now, this third discourse, like all the discourses, actually, There are going to be seven of them altogether. They're highly poetic with a regular meter. An interesting question here is, well, did God reveal the oracle to Balaam this way? Did he give it to him in poetry, or did God just give Balaam the information and then Balaam took and arranged it as poetry? I don't know the answer to that weighty question. I don't think it really matters. Now, in verse 3, some people have accused Balaam of being arrogant because he says, hey, this is the oracle of the man whose eye is opened. I see it all. I know what I'm talking about. I really don't think so. I think Balaam is just relaying the truth because it is objectively true that his eye was open and his eyes uncovered, and he's just relaying what happened. He's seen the vision of the Almighty. What does vision of the Almighty mean? Well, Gill suggests, but then rejects, the idea that the vision Balaam is talking about is when the angel of the Lord met him on the way down from Pethor down to Moab, when the ass talked, when Balaam had to deal with his recalcitrant talking donkey, and then Balaam saw the angel of Jehovah standing there. So that's the vision that is referred to. Some say, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. Gill suggests another idea. He says that when Balaam says that he sees the vision of the Almighty, he's in a trance. In fact, the King James has Balaam is falling down, falling into a trance. They add that falling into a trance. It's not in the original Hebrew. Sort of an interpretation there. You can fall down without being in a trance. And I suspect that's what happened. He fell down without being in a trance, because I don't believe he was in a trance. As Adam Clark said, quote, there is no indication in the Hebrew that he fell into a trance. These words are added by our translators, i.e. the KJV translators, but they are not in the original. The Hebrew nofel is the only word used and simply signifies falling or falling down, perhaps in this instance by way of religious prostration. Yes, I think that's what happened. But again, what is the vision talking about? It's not talking about the angel of Jehovah with the talking ass incident. It's not talking about a vision as in a trance. So what does that mean? Well, I just think it means in the vision of the Lord, this means the vision of the Almighty. It just means he sees. He understands what the oracles are. And therefore, he can relate these oracles to Balak, knowing that he's seen what God sees. He understands what God's telling him. Falling down, yet having his eyes uncovered, that means he sees. That's basically, again, he sees, he understands. So Balaam is starting out here talking to Balak, saying, I understand what I'm talking about. And here he goes with his third discourse, starting in verse 5, going through verse 7. How fair are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel. Of course, Jacob is another word for Israel. Like valleys that stretch out, like gardens beside the river, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars beside the waters. Water will flow from his buckets, and his seed will be by many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Now, this is a very favorable prophecy toward Israel. Let's break it down a little bit. First of all, Israel's tents are fair. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean it refers to Israel as they are now situated, camped tribe by tribe in military martial array? John Gill says this, quote, long and broad, lying between several mountains and reaching from hill to hill. So the armies of Israel lay encamped in the plains and villages of Moab, making a very considerable length and breadth. From hill to hill, remember they're on a plain of Moab, but there's hills that interrupt this plain. And so from in the valleys, they're on the plain from hill to hill. You got all these armies stretched out. That's one option as to why Balaam says that Israel's tents are fair. Another option is that Balaam is referring to Israel as they will be settled in their land in the future when they get to the promised land. That's the NIV Study Bible's idea, as opposed to Gill. Quite frankly, it could be both. It could be how fair are your tents now as I'm looking at them, as Balaam looks at them, and how fair are your tents later when Israel gets to the promised land. Now, verse 6 compares Israel to gardens beside the river. That means that Israel was well watered and fruitful, and I suspect that is referring to the future. Israel in verse 6 is compared to aloes planted by the Lord. Of course, now we know what aloes are because it's very popular in America now. It's some kind of a plant that when you make it into a gel, it's very healing and aromatic. You put it on sunburn and skin problems and stuff like that. So the idea is that Israel is aromatic and healing. Like cedars beside the waters. Now, cedars, of course, are strong and durable. They're waterproof, even though they're growing in the water. So Israel will be strong and durable. Not exactly a curse, is it? More like a blessing that Balaam is giving. Psalm 92:12, the righteous man will flourish like the palm tree. He will grow like a cedar in Lebanon. So cedars are considered to be prosperous and strong. Verse 7 says, water will flow from his buckets, from Israel's buckets. Water is necessary for prosperous agriculture. And if you got water flowing from the buckets of the planters of Israel, well, that means they got plenty of water to have prosperous agriculture. Verse 7 also says that Israel's seed will be by many waters. As John Gill says on this verse, quote, the seed and offspring of Israel shall be in a place of many waters and a land of brooks and waters. The seed shall dwell in a well-watered land, the land of Canaan. So that's what it's talking about there, the waters, well-watered promised land. His seed, that means Israel's descendants. His king shall be higher than Agag. Well, before I go to that, let's talk again about this idea of waters showing prosperity. Deuteronomy 8, showing that the promised land will be full of waters and full of prosperity. Deuteronomy 8, 7. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs. So water there is a symbol of life and prosperity. Isaiah 32, 20. How blessed will you be, you who sow beside all waters? Revelation 17, 1, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. Now let's take a minute here on this verse in Revelation 17, 1. When I did my podcast on Revelation 17, 1, I said that the harlot here, the whore of Babylon, stands for apostate Israel. She's sitting on many waters because the original Babylon was a city of canals. There was many waters, and so that was the imagery that was trying to show that the whore was sitting on Babylon and Israel, the apostate Israel, being the new Babylon. Well, here's another idea. If it refers to apostate Israel, and I believe it does, then the whore, if she refers to apostate Israel, and I believe she does, then the whore is sitting on a land of many waters. Literally, Israel has many waters. Not just the old Babylon has many waters, but the new Israel has many waters. This is an idea I never thought about until just now. Here's what John Gill says about that. The seed and offspring of Israel shall be a place of many waters and a land of brooks and waters. Shall dwell in a well-watered land, the land of Canaan, or shall be like seed sown near water, or in well-watered places, which springs up and brings forth much fruit, or shall become or be over many waters, to which people, kingdoms, and nations are sometimes compared, and so may denote the multitude of Israel and the large extent of their dominions. And then Gill says, see Revelation 17:1. So Gill takes it the same way as I do, that the whore Babylon is apostate Israel, and those many waters stand for all the wars that are in the promised land. So a little nuance there. Now we can go to verse 7 and see that Israel's king should be higher than Agag. Now Agag, of course, is the name of the king of the Amalekites, just as Pharaoh is the name of the king of the Egyptians, and so there are lots of Agags. But now what is mentioned here that the king of Israel will be higher than Agag, what's being prophesied here by Balaam? The NIV Study Bible gives option one, that this is a prophecy concerning the future opponent of King Saul. This famous passage in 1 Samuel 15, verses 32 through 33. Then Samuel said, bring me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And Agag came to him cheerfully. And Agag said, surely the bitterness of death is past. Yeah, that's what he thought. But Samuel said, as your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. And Samuel hewed Agag to pieces before the Lord at Gilgal. Yikes. Well, so if this is what Balaam is referring to, then it would be his king, Israel's king, i.e. Saul, shall be higher than Agag, the Agag that was cheerfully walked to his death and defeated by Saul. I think that's probably the answer. And that's what the NIV Study Bible holds. The NIV Study Bible gives another option as to how the king of Israel will be higher than Agag, referring to how Israel beat the Amalekites and Agag their king at Rephidim, which was right before they got to Mount Sinai on the Exodus. So I'm just going to read you that passage there. It's very famous, Exodus 17, 8 through 13. Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. Rephidim is just a hop, skip, and a jump away from Mount Sinai, on the way to Mount Sinai. So Moses said to Joshua, choose men for us and go out, fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed, and when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. So that means, so this is another option to explain what Balaam meant when he said that Israel's king would be higher than Agag. Well, the problem here, in my opinion, is that Israel doesn't have a king here at Rephidim. They got Moses, but he's not a king. Moses was their leader. So that doesn't seem to be a clean fit to me. I think Samuel beating Agag, I think that's probably the better fulfillment of Balaam's prophecy. And of course, we got another incident where the Amalekites fought the Israelites. This was right after the spies came back at Kadesh Barnea with a bad report. And the Israelites foolishly decided they would go ahead and advance anyway. After God said, retreat down to Eilat, back to the Red Sea, and they didn't do it, and they charged. And then, Numbers 14:45, then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and struck them and beat them down as far as Hormah, which is near Kadesh. Hormah means destruction. And so there, the Israelite king was obviously not higher than the Amalekites. So it can't be that. So we see this constant enmity between Israel and the Amalekites. Eventually, Saul beat them. And so Balaam's prophecy was true. So this is true prophecy. Remember, the Spirit of God is on him. He might have been a false pagan prophet, but he's giving true prophecy now. We go down to Numbers 24:8-9. God brings him out of Egypt, brings Israel out of Egypt. He is for him. He is for Israel like the horns of a wild ox. The horns, of course, of the place of strongest strength of an animal, of an ox. I assume that's a bull. That word ox is so aggravating the way it's translated because, well, anyway, it's a bull. The horns of the wild ox, he will devour the nations who are his adversaries and will crush their bones in pieces and shatter them with his arrows. That's a great cursing, isn't it? Balak's listening to all this, thinking that he had hired Balaam to curse Israel, and this is what he's saying. In verse 9, Balaam continues, he, that's Israel, couches. He lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him? Blessed is everyone who blesses you, and cursed is everyone who curses you. Well, Balak wants to curse Israel, and Balaam said, yeah, you curse Israel, and you're going to get cursed yourself. So the Exodus is cited. Now, this is an interesting thing about the Exodus. It's often quoted all through the Old Testament because it was the central event concerning Israel's salvation. And here, the Exodus is quoted by a hostile outsider even. So this is a big deal. The NIV Study Bible points that out. This idea of God being like the horns of a wild ox, being that which will gore an enemy. God will do that. He will gore Israel's enemies. It's repeated from Numbers 23:22. God brings them out of Egypt. He is for them like the horns of the wild ox. NIV Study Bible says ox, the symbol of an ox, is a traditional image of power in the Near East. Now, verse 9, Israel is said to crouch like a lion. That could describe Israel as presently laid out in the plain of Moab, just crouching, just waiting to cross the Jordan River and start wiping out Canaanites. Now, verse 9, Balaam says, and as a lion, who dares rouse him? Think about it. You got a lion, he's crouched, he's getting ready to attack, and you can go up and pet him on his mane and say, hey, lion, how you doing? Rousing a lion like that is getting ready to pounce on somebody. That's plain stupidity. And the implication here is, Balak, it would really be stupid for you to rouse Israel at this point and try to attack them or curse them, because they're getting ready, they're crouched, and they're getting ready to attack other people. Don't be a fool, Balak. Blessed is everyone who blesses you, Israel, and curses everyone who cursed you. Now Balaam sounds like he's trying to identify himself with Abraham's blessing on Israel, as the NIV Study Bible points out. This bless who will bless you, curse who will curse you language comes from Genesis 12 and Genesis 27. Genesis 12 verses 2 and 3. And I, Yahweh, will make you a great nation, Abraham, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. Genesis 27:29. Now it's Isaac. God's dealing with Isaac. May peoples serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master of your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you, and blessed be those who bless you. So Balaam uses more or less the exact words that Isaac used to bless Jacob. This is Isaac's blessing of Jacob I just read in Genesis 27, and also Abraham's word in Genesis 12, same words, basically. Interesting, is it not, that God uses a pagan prophet to continue his promises of Abrahamic blessings to the people of Israel? We go down to Numbers 24, verses 10 through 14. Then Balak's anger burned against Balaam, and he struck his hands together. And Balak said to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have persisted in blessing them these three times. Therefore, flee to your palace now. Flee to your place now. I said I would honor you greatly, but behold, the Lord has held you back from honor. Balaam said to Balak, did I not tell your messengers whom you had sent to me? Balak had sent two embassies up from Moab up to Pethor where Balaam lived. And Balaam says to Balak, did I not tell your messengers whom you had sent to me, saying, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything contrary to the command of the Lord, either good or bad, of my own accord. What the Lord speaks, that I will speak. Didn't I tell you that? Verse 14, and now behold, I am going to my people. Come, and I will advise you what this people will do to your people in the days to come. So Balaam is unfazed by Balak's anger. He says, I got some more bad news for you, buddy, in the days to come. So quit bellyaching. Now when Balak struck his hands together, striking your hands together amongst Oriental people is an indication of violent rage, and I can understand how Balak would be quite upset listening to the first three oracles of Balaam. And Balak immediately says, hey, I would honor you greatly, but the Lord has held you back from honor. He doesn't directly blame Balaam for giving up on the money. That honor means money. He doesn't directly blame Balaam. He says, God has held you back from honor. But he's making fun of him. He says, yeah, you had a chance to make a whole bunch of money, and it's gone now. The NIV Study Bible said this is the ultimate insult to Balaam's greed. Adam Clark says this was a bitter and impious sarcasm. He's ticked off. Notice the word honor is used in the sense of financial reward. Think of that. Honor the elders. Plural now, elders, not the senior pastor. Honor the elders who work hard. The idea of honor is an honorarium, is money, voluntarily given, not as a salary. So here, this was, I would honor you greatly, I would give you great financial reward. But you threw it away, Balaam. All right, verse 13, Balaam is talking to Balak and said, hey, even though you, Balak, were to give me your house full of silver and gold, I don't care, a house full of silver and gold. That's the same words that the messengers of Balak came from Moab to Pethor. Numbers 22:18. Balaam replied to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything, either small or great, contrary to the command of the Lord my God. So he's still using that extravagant language. I'm going to take a house full of silver and gold to speak contrary to God. Now in verse 14, Balaam says, behold, I'm going to my people. Come, I will advise you what this people will do to your people in the days to come. When he says, I'm going to my people, basically what Balaam is saying, I'm going back home, going back up to Syria in Pethor, near Carchemish up there. But before I go, I'll give you some more bad news. What's going to happen in the days to come? Now, exactly what did he mean by that? Here's option one. The days to come refers to what David did to Moab in the future. Remember now, we're about 1400 or so B.C. David is about 1000 or so B.C. So we're talking about 400 years before David. Well, David finally wipes out Moab. 2 Samuel 8:2. He, David, defeated Moab and measured them with the line, making them lie down on the ground. And he measured two lines to put to death and one full line to keep alive. And the Moabites became servants to David, bringing tribute. So that could be what Moab is referring to about the days to come. John Gill has another option. He says that Balaam is referring to what the Jews did to Moab in the Hellenistic period, in the times of Alexander, King Janaeus, Alexander Janaeus, who was the second Hasmonean king, reigned from 103 BC to 76 BC, and the Hasmoneans wiped out the Moabites, as Josephus relates. Well, maybe. I think it's better to say that David whopped them during his time, about 900 years before the Moabites, before Alexander Janaeus. And so basically he's saying, hey, baby, Balak, your people are doomed because of these people that you want me to curse. We go now to verses 15 and 16 of Numbers 24. He took up his discourse, that's Balaam, took up his discourse and said, this is Balaam's fourth oracle, the oracle of Balaam the son of Beor, and the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty falling down yet having his eye uncovered. Now, this introduction to the fourth oracle that we're getting ready to read, that we have just read, is the same as the introduction to the third oracle, except that Balaam added, and knows the knowledge of the Most High. So he's getting more confident. Of course, some people say he was cocky, but I just think he's confident. He wants to appear confident before Balak. Now, this long introduction gets the reader ready for the startling prophecy that's coming. Now, Balaam claims to have the knowledge of the Most High. This is actually true. How do we know this? How does Balaam show that he has the knowledge of God? Well, for one reason, he uses God's name, Yahweh. He calls him Yahweh. Now, sometimes he does call him God, like the general word for God, like Elohim. Numbers 23:8, how can I curse someone God has not cursed? There's God. How can I denounce someone the Lord Yahweh has not denounced? So he uses God and Yahweh in the same passage, but still he's using Yahweh as he does it a lot of times, actually, uses Yahweh. So that shows that he has some knowledge of the true Lord, the true God. But John Gill says this knowledge was only intellectual and speculative. It was not spiritual and supernatural, and I think I would agree with that. John Gill says Balaam professed to know God, but he didn't do the works of God. And then Gill quotes 1 Corinthians 13:2, if I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but I do not have love, I am nothing. And Gill's jibe there is that Balaam doesn't know anything. He knows knowledge. He knows how to prophesy, but he doesn't have love. He doesn't have love of God. In other words, if I might paraphrase Gill, Balaam knew God from fear, just the way that a Muslim knows Allah, through fear, not through relationship. We turn now to Numbers 24:17. Balaam continues, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. He's referring to I see God. A star shall come forth from Jacob. A scepter shall rise from Israel and shall crush through the forehead of Moab and tear down all the sons of Sheth. Well, another sad prophecy for Moab. I'm sure Balak's getting madder and madder. Now, when Balaam says, I see him, he means I prophetically see him through the spirit of prophecy. He sees Yahweh, but not near. I behold him, but not near. That means that Balak had nothing to fear because God is not going to do anything to him right now because God is not near. And after all, Moses had said he would harmlessly bypass Moab. We find that in Judges 11:17. Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom saying, please let us travel through your land. But the king of Edom would not listen. They also sent messengers to the king of Moab, but he refused. So Balaam gives the prophecy about a star coming forth from Jacob. Jacob, of course, is Israel. Who's the star? That's Jesus. That's the Messiah. And the word star is paralleled with, according to the customs of and the conventions of Hebrew poetry, a star shall come forth from Jacob, a scepter from Israel. Jacob is parallel with Israel, and star is parallel with scepter. So it's the same person being referred to, the Messiah. The scepter, of course, is a symbol of rule, and the star is a symbol of light. As John Gill puts it, a star is a symbol of glory, brightness, splendor, and light. And also a star rises in the sky a lot of times as you look at it. So these are messianic prophecies by this pagan prophet. Kind of interesting. Now, I said it was the Messiah. That is one option as to how that prophecy fulfilled. Another option is this just referring to David, because David literally crushed the forehead of Moab. As we've already read in that passage where, well, let's read it here. That's 2 Samuel 8:2. He, that's David, defeated Moab and measured them with a line, making them lie down on the ground. And measured two lines to put to death and one full line to keep alive. And the Moabites became servants to David, bringing tribute. Okay, so there, it's fulfilled in David. But David is so typological of Jesus the Messiah. So most people say the star and the scepter is Jesus the Messiah coming out of Israel, out of Jacob. Even if that prophecy was fulfilled preliminary in David, David's a type of the ultimate Messiah. Here's what John Gill says about that quote. There are some writers, both Jewish and Christian, that understand the prophecy partly of David and partly of Christ, and chiefly of him, chiefly of Christ, and of David as a type of him, the fulfillment of which was only in part in David, but principally and completely in Christ. And that majority opinion, I think, is the opinion I hold too. Now, if it is Jesus if it is Jesus who is fulfilling this prophecy, then we have a little problem here because Jesus shall crush through the forehead of Moab and tear down all the sons of Sheth. I'll talk about the sons of Sheth in a minute. That's basically the Moabites. So how does Jesus fulfill that prophecy of smashing the foreheads of the Moabites. Well, you have to take the Moabites as a symbol of God's enemies. Likewise, the Edomites too, God's enemies. For example, in Revelation 19:15, we read this, from his mouth comes a sharp sword, that's Jesus, so that with it he may strike down the nations. The nations, okay, that would include the Moabites. And he will rule them with a rod of iron. So the idea is the Moabites and Edomites are just typical of the anti-God nations of the world. And Jesus ends up whopping them on the head, crushing them in the forehead. I think it's better. I like to fulfill it literally in David, because David literally fulfilled that prophecy, and then it's a great type of what happens in the future. I'm conservative on types, but some types are so obvious they kind of scream at you. Revelation 22:16 sort of gives this idea of Jesus as a fulfillment of the Davidic type. I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you these things for the churches. I am the root and the descendant of David, the bright morning star. So Jesus himself calls himself a star in the book of Revelation. So I think Balaam's prediction of a star coming out of Israel fits Jesus very well. And in Revelation 22:16, Jesus says he's the descendant of David. So everything fits together pretty closely. David is a type and Jesus is the ultimate fulfillment. But whatever the fulfillment is, this prophecy showed a great future for Israel, which was quite the opposite of what Balak had asked Balaam down from Pethor down to Moab for. He's not getting what he bargained for. Now, some people say that this star, the star that comes out of Israel, refers to the literal star that came from the Middle East to Bethlehem at the time of Jesus' birth. I don't believe that. Now, John Gill says the Jews expected the appearance of an extraordinary star at the time of the Messiah's coming. They say so more once in an ancient book of theirs, says John Gill. So the Jews are expecting a star, but that's a star. That's not the Messiah. Besides, it's in parallel with scepter. How is a star a scepter? How is the star a rule? That's a, to take it that way, you're talking about a literal star rather than a person. And that doesn't make sense to me. Adam Clark agrees with me here. He says this, quote, I cannot think that the meteoric star which guided the wise men of the east to Bethlehem can be intended here. Nor do I think that Peter refers to this prophecy when he calls Christ the day star in 2 Peter 1:19. Nor that Revelation 2:28 where Christ is called the morning star. I agree. I don't think that's talking about this literal star at Bethlehem. Nor Revelation 22:16, that's the verse I just read, where he is called the bright morning star. I don't think that Clark says, I don't think that any of these verses refer at all to this prophecy of Balaam. I agree. Now, Clark finally states a little bit of diffidence here. He says, it is exceedingly difficult to fix the true sense of this prophecy in all its particulars. Well, I gave you all sides. I just think it's easier to say, is David literally as a type to be fulfilled in Christ? Now, the prophet Balaam also said that Israel would tear down all the sons of Sheth. Well, who is Sheth? Well, Sheth is possibly the early inhabitants of Moab, so the sons of Sheth would be the current-day Moabites. This is according to John Gill. He says that the Shutu people are named in ancient Egyptian documents as the Moabites. That makes sense. Sheth, Shutu, that's close. Now, there's a translation issue here. The version I'm using, which is the NASB, says that the scepter, the star, the Messiah, will tear down all the sons of Sheth. Well, the NIV says that instead of tear down, it should be skull, so it should be read like this. And the star of the scepter shall crush through the forehead of Moab and crush the star, crush the skulls of all the sons of Sheth. Crush the forehead of Moab and crush the skulls parallel again. Basically, your head gets smashed in, Moabites. I like that a little bit better. But again, it's a translation issue. It doesn't matter, make a piece of difference. The point is Moab is going to go down. We go down to Numbers 24, verses 18 through 19. Edom will become a possession. Syria will become a possession of its enemies. But Israel will be triumphant. One who comes from Jacob will rule. He will destroy the city's survivors. Now, did Edom become a possession after this prophecy? Well, there's lots of opinions on this. In my opinion, the first one is the correct option, that David will beat the Edomites and make them a possession. Jameson Fursett Brown is absolutely certain of that, and he agrees with me. John Gill suggested it. Let's read where David beat the Edomites. 2 Samuel 8:14. He, that's David, put garrisons in Edom. And all Edom he put garrisons. And all the Edomites became servants to David. Psalm 68 through 9. Moab is my washbowl. Over Edom I shall throw my shoe, which shows possession. When you throw your shoe over land, that means you own it. Shout loud, O Philistia, because of me, who will bring me into the besieged city, who will lead me to Edom. So that's, again, the idea that David has got Edom. Psalm 108, 9 says similar things. Moab is my washbowl. Over Edom I shall throw my shoe. All right, so that's the option I'm going to go with. Other people say or point out that Judas Maccabeus beat the Edomites in 1 Maccabees 5:3, so Edom became a possession of the Maccabees. John Gill mentions that Hyrcanus, again in the intertestamental period, the Hasmonean era, Hyrcanus beat them. Let me give you the quote here. And they became one people with the Jews and conformed to their religious rites, which is not only related by Josephus, but by Strabo, and heathen historian, who says that they joined themselves to the Jews and embraced their laws. So that's when the Edomites became a possession of the Jews. And of course, Herod was an Edomite himself, an Idumean, and of course, he was pretty merged in with the Jews. So that could be, but at any rate, Edom gets disappeared and Israel is triumphant, just like the prophecy said. Now, some people say that Edom becomes a possession of Israel at the times of the Messiah, mentioned by Gill and Clark. Some Jewish writers think this is so. Obadiah 1:21 says this, the deliverers will ascend Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau. And Esau, of course, is the founder of Edom. The mountain of Esau, that's Edom. The deliverers will ascend Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. Of course, if you fulfill that messianically, that means that Edom, as a symbol of pagan nations, gets wiped out by the kingdom of God. Well, that's nice. That's how prophecies are often fulfilled, typologically. But I prefer to say that this is referring literally to when David whooped up on the Edomites. Seir, that's the name of the mountain range that's down there in Edom, south of the Dead Sea, south of the Zered Brook there, right south of Moab. Those mountains are there. They're called, it's a mountain range, really, and Seir therefore becomes a synecdoche, standing for Edom, the part standing for the whole. Now, in verse 19, it says, one who comes from Jacob will rule. Now, who is that one? Well, it could be the same David we've been talking about, or it could be the Messiah. David is a type of the Messiah. This recalls, of course, Genesis 49:10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. Now, scepter means rule, so one who comes from Jacob will rule. David's ruling, that would be Judah. And, of course, Judah is the ancestor of Jesus. So the scepter shall not depart from Judah, because Jesus is going to inherit the rule over the nation of Israel. And of course, that is the old Israel, and the new Israel is the kingdom of Christ. Well, again, I think we'd take it this way. The one who comes from Jacob will rule. That's King David as the type, and the antitype is Jesus. David, or he, will destroy the city's survivors. What does that refer to? In a battle, in a siege warfare, those who flee from the field to fortified places so they can be safe from the marauding enemy's armies. They go to the city for possession, and then you have to besiege the city, and then when you take the city, you destroy all those in the city who have survived the war so far. That's what refers to the city survivors. And again, that's just a military metaphor saying Jesus is going to whip up on these Edomites, or David is going to whip up on the Edomites. All of this happens, so Balaam is prophesying truly now by the Holy Spirit. We go now to Numbers 24:20. And he, that's Balaam, looked at Amalek and took up his discourse, and this is the fifth discourse, and said, Amalek was the first of the nation, but his end shall be destruction. Now, where is the country of Amalek? Well, if you look at Israel, look at the southern desert in Israel, the Negev, and go even further south than that, kind of south of the Dead Sea, and then move west toward the Mediterranean Sea, that's Amalek. And then if you go south of the southern beach of the Mediterranean Sea and go and keep going west to where you're under the lip of the Mediterranean Sea and you're heading toward Egypt, toward the eastern delta region, the desert of Shur, it's called. That's Amalek. That's where they lived. In the desert south of Israel, south and southwest of Israel, and the desert east of Egypt. That's where Amalek was. Numbers 13:29, first part of the verse says, Amalek is living in the land of the Negev. That's the Negev, is the southern desert. Now, when Balaam is here, he's further north than that. He is at the top end of the northern end of the Dead Sea, and he could look down to his left, to his south, and get a good view of the Negev desert going over to Shur, and he can see Amalek. Now, Balaam looked at Amalek. He literally looked at Amalek over in that desert, And he says Amalek was the first of the nations. Well, what does that mean, the first? It means the first nation to attack Israel, as the NIV Study Bible and John Gill say. And that was at the famous fight at Rephidim, which I've already read you about, when Moses got tired, had to sit down on a rock. Aaron and Hur held up his left and right hand, and when they did so, Joshua would fight in the battle. He would win against the Amalekites, and when they let Moses' hand down, Joshua would start losing. And anyway, Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with a sword, and that was the end of that. So they were the first nation to attack, the first of the nation, but his end shall be destruction. So let's look at the history of Amalek. Starting in Deuteronomy 25, verse 19, therefore it shall come about when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your surrounding enemies in the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You must not forget. God's upset with Amalek because they tried to wipe out the Israelites there at Rephidim right before Mount Sinai, first month or so during the Exodus. And God says, okay, I'm going to remember this. When the Israelites get and establish themselves in the land of Canaan, they're going to wipe you out, Amalek. Next verse, 1 Samuel 15, 7 through 8. So Saul defeated the Amalekites. Now that's about 400 years later. Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havil as you go to Shur. That's that same desert I told you about, east of Egypt. And this desert that separates Egypt and the southern end of Israel. So Saul defeated the Amalekites there, as you go to Shur, which is east of Egypt. He captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, live and utterly destroyed all the people at the edge of the sword. If you recall that when he sliced up Amalekite. I read that in another verse. I won't read it again. And then we see in 1 Samuel 27, verses 8 through 9, we're past Saul. We're now into the time of David, Saul's successor. Now David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites and the Gerzites and the Amalekites, our guys, the Amalekites, for they were the inhabitants of the land from ancient times. As you come to Shur, again, we're in that same area, even as far as the land of Egypt, because Shur separates Egypt from Israel. David attacked the land and did not leave a man or a woman alive, and he took away the sheep, the cattle, the donkeys, the camels, and the clothing. Then he returned and came to Achish. So David, Achish is in Philistia, the Gaza area, Gaza Strip area, modern-day Israel, and southwest of Israel. And he just went further south down into Shur and wiped out the Amalekites. So Saul's wiping them out. David's wiping them out. Now let's see the very end of the Amalekites. 1 Chronicles 4:41. This is in the time of Hezekiah, who ruled from 715 B.C. to 686 B.C. Most people have his dates around there. These, referring to Simeon's descendants, recorded by name, came in the days of Hezekiah. Again, we're talking about a good 300 years after, or maybe 250 years after David, 200 or 300 years after David. In the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, and these Simeon's descendants attacked their tents and the Meunites who were found there and destroyed them utterly to this day, and they lived in their place because there was pasture for their flocks. Drop down to verse 43, 1 Chronicles 4. They destroyed the remnant of the Amalekites who escaped and have lived there to this day. So Hezekiah picked on the rump of the Amalekites, and they're gone now because, as John Gill says, after that verse in 1 Chronicles 4:41, in the reign of Hezekiah, the Amalekites disappear from history. And so, once again, Balaam's prophecy came true. He was a true prophet, although he didn't love God, but God said, you tell the people the truth here because I'm going to use you as my mouthpiece. We go down to Numbers 24, verses 21 through 22. Next, he, that's Balaam, saw the Kenites and proclaimed his poem or his discourse. Your dwelling place is enduring. Your nest is set in the cliffs. Cain will be destroyed when Asher takes you captive. That's capital K-I-A-I-N. I'll explain that in a minute. Now, this poem, as the Holman Christian Study Bible has it, the NASB has a discourse. This is the sixth discourse. Now, who are these Kenites that he's looking at now? Well, here's some options. Option number one, it could be the family and posterity of Jethro, Moses' father-in-law. Now, those Midianites lived at the southeastern end of the Sinai Peninsula, and then you cross the Gulf of Aqaba going east, and you end up in southern, present-day southern Jordan or northern Saudi Arabia in that area. That's where the Midianites were. Those were the good Midianites that Moses married into. We read some scriptures referring to that. Exodus 3:1. Now, Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. Now, Midian, as I say, is also referring to Kenites. A Midianite is a Kenite. And we know that from Judges 1:16, the descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, that's Jethro. And so in Exodus 3:1, Jethro is called a priest of Midian, and in Judges 1:16, he's called a Kenite. So that's how you put the two together. So the descendants of the Kenite went up from the city of palms with the sons of Judah, dot, 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 dot. All right, so that's option number one, who the Kenites were, Moses' relatives from back home, his in-laws. Option number two, the Kenites are a clan that is now residing with Israel under the name of the Rechabites, and these options are not mutually exclusive. These could be family members from Midian who came up and later took the name of Rechabites. But just to keep it simple, we'll just say this is another option here. The Rechabites, these would be Kenites who are now camped with Israel and traveling with them on their sojourns. Traveling under the name of the Rechabites, as John Gill says, we read about them in 1 Chronicles 2:55, second part of the verse. Those are the Kenites who came from Hamath, the father of the house of Rechab, R-E-C-H-A-B, Rechab. So Kenites are said to be Rechabites there. And about 1 Chronicles 2:55 that I just read is from a list showing returnees from the Babylonian exile. If they're coming back from the Babylonian exile, that means they've been in the nation of Israel for a while. Babylonian exile was 586, and the return was 538, if I remember correctly, maybe 537. And so the Rechabites have been with them for a good while. Jeremiah 35:2 refers to the Rechabites, and again, that's right before the, or right around the time of the exile, 586 BC. Go to the house of the Rechabites and speak to them and bring them into the house of the Lord, into one of the chambers, and give them wine to drink. All right, so that's option number two, the Midianites or Rechabites. And now, of course, those are friendly Kenites. I mean, Moses' in-laws, they're friendly. His Midianite in-laws are Kenites. They're friendly. Option number two, the Rechabites. Well, they've been camping with Israel all the way up through the exile and returning from the exile, so those are good Kenites. But now remember, well, Balaam, in his prophecy here, in the sixth discourse, he doesn't really say that Israel is going to wipe out the Kenites. So those first two options are live. It's Assyria that's going to wipe out the Kenites, not the Israelites. So option number one's a live option. It could be in-laws of Moses. Option number two, the Rechabites. Option number three, a people dwelling near the Amalekites, and these are the bad guy Kenites. They might, again, these options are not mutually exclusive. These could have come from the same family as Jethro, Moses' mother-in-law, and they ended up taking up residence with the Amalekites. But just to keep it simple, let's just say this is option number three, a people dwelling near the Amalekites. We read in 1 Samuel 15:6, Saul said to the Kenites, go depart, go down from among the Amalekites, so that I do not destroy you with them, for you showed kindness to all the sons of Israel when they came up from Egypt. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. I think I just said these Kenites were bad Kenites. I really shouldn't have said that, just because they're associated with the Amalekites. Because right here, Saul says, you showed kindness to the sons of Israel. I mean, that could have been Jethro's relative. Moses' relative, Jethro and his people. So those could be good Kenites too. So, all three options. Moses' in-laws, option one. Option number two, the Rechabites. Option number three, the people living near the Amalekites, who Saul spared by telling them to vamoose from the vicinity of the Amalekites. Whoever they are, Asher is going to take them captive. Now, that's not as bad as the Amalekites. The Amalekites are going to get killed, but Asher, which is Assyria is going to capture the Kenites. Now, when Balaam, in his sixth prophecy here, says your dwelling place is enduring, your nest is set in the cliffs, there's a pun on that word nest, because ken means nest in the Hebrew. Kenite is a nester. The NIV Study Bible says that the name Kenite suggests a tribe of metal workers. Now, I don't know where in the world they get metal worker and nest at the same time. So since I don't know Hebrew and I can't explore that, we're just going to say that the Kenites have a nest that's set in the cliffs. Again, a play on the words there. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about the Kenites nestling in the cliffs. Quote, though securely established among the clefts in the high rocks of En-Gedi towards the west. En-Gedi is on the west side of the Dead Sea, about halfway down. It was kind of an oasis. I've actually been by there. They got a McDonald's there, of all places, in the middle of the desert right there at En-Gedi. I guess every oasis needs a McDonald's. So the Kenites are in the high rocks of En-Gedi. According to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, they should be gradually reduced by a succession of enemies till the Assyrian invader carried them into captivity. And he gives a lot of quotes where the Assyrians come in. Now, it doesn't say exactly when that happens. Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria could have carried them off when he invaded Syria. This is in 2 Kings 69. You remember recently there's a whole series of battles between Assyria and Syria. And then, of course, you got Shalmaneser. I think, what is that? Shalmaneser the third. I can't remember which one he is. I think he's the third. Might have been the fifth. I'm sorry, Shalmaneser the fifth, I think it was. Anyway, I forgot. Forget I even said it. I can't go by my memory, but he carried off the 10 northern tribes. That was in 722 BC. Or it could be when Sennacherib came in the 715, 687. I forgot the exact date. It's the very end of the 8th century BC. When Sennacherib came into Israel and scared Hezekiah out of his wits. And some people even say it could be Nebuchadnezzar, who, although he's Babylonian, some people say he's really an Assyrian. I don't know. The point is that at some point of the Assyrian depredations on Israel, the Kenites meet their doom, and they're gone. So basically what Balaam is doing here, he's looking around at all the pagan tribes and saying, you've had it. This nation, chosen by God, is going to kick your fanny and going to wipe you out. One last point, verse 22, Cain will be destroyed when Asher takes you captive. What is Cain, capital K-I-N? Well, the best way to solve that is to look at other translations. Now, the translation I just read was Homer Christian Study Bible that referred to capital K-I-A-N, N-A-S-B, same verse, calls it Cain also. Nevertheless, Cain will be consumed. But the KJV and the Young's Literal Translation tell us how it should be translated, or at least what Cain means. Numbers 24:22 KJV, nevertheless the Kenite shall be wasted until Asher shall carry thee away captive. So Cain's just another name for the Kenites, the Kenite nation. Young's Literal Translation, Numbers 24:22, but the Kenite is for a burning. All right, so Cain stands for the Kenites. Now, verse 22 says that the Kenites will be captive, but on the other hand, the Amalekites will be destroyed, Kenites merely captured. And in fact, that's why Saul, in the verse I previously read, why Saul later on told the Kenites to scram from the Amalekites' presence. First Samuel 15:6, he, that's Saul, warned the Kenites, since you showed kindness to all the Israelites when they came out of Egypt, go on and leave, get away from the Amalekites, or I'll sweep you away with them. So the Kenites withdrew from the Amalekites. We go now to Numbers 24, verses 23 through 25, and we will finish this audio. Once more, he, that's Balaam, proclaimed his poem. That's Homer Christian Study Bible calls it a poem. I like discourse better. That's what most of the other translations have. NIV, I think, has oracle. NASB has discourse. This is the seventh discourse. By the way, the Amplified Bible explicitly numbers all his discourses. That's why I'm going to go by what they say, seven discourses. And also Wikipedia, in their article on Balaam, has Balaam giving seven discourses. So I'm going to go with that. I think in my last audio, I said there were four. My bad. I shouldn't have said that. So here we go with discourse number seven. Balaam says, ah, who can live when God does this? Ships will come from the coast of Kittim. They will afflict Asher and Eber, but they too will come to destruction. Balaam then arose and went back to his homeland, and Balak also went his way. Now, first problem, when Balaam says, who can live when God does this? God does what? Well, I think most logically it means is when the Assyrians destroy the Kenites, which you just mentioned in the last verse. Remember, the Assyrians are going to capture the Kenites. I guess I should read it again. Let me go up here and read it. Cain, or the Kenites, will be destroyed when Asher takes you captive. And then you go to the next verse and say, ah, who can live when God does this? In other words, who can live long enough to see the Assyrians beat the Kenites? Because it did take a while. But on the other hand, it could be what Balaam is getting ready to refer to, which is ships from the coast of Kittim coming in and afflicting Asher and Eber, Israel. When did that happen? Well, that happened, well, it depends on how you interpret this verse, but the way I'm going to interpret it is about 1200s BC or so. That's a long time from the time of this prophecy, which is about 1450 or so. So you're talking about a couple of centuries, two or three centuries later, and nobody's going to be living when God does this. Verse 24 says, ships will come from the coast of Kittim. Now, Kittim is probably Cyprus, as the NIV Study Bible says. Most people say it's Cyprus. But there are other options as Kittim. Some people say it refers to the Romans. Some people says it refers to the Macedonians and Alexander the Great. No, we're not going to go with all that. That makes things much too complicated. So we're going to say Kittim is Cyprus, and I'll show you how that fits pretty good here in just a minute. And then these ships from Kittim will afflict Asher. That's Assyria. Asher was the first town in Assyria, the empire of Assyria. and Eber. Now, Eber, of course, Eber does not necessarily mean the Hebrews, but a lot of people think it does. I'm going to take it as Hebrews because it makes sense for my interpretation here, which is the easiest one, and I think it's the majority one also. Now, all of these names, Kittim and Eber, Asher is not controversial. Everybody knows that's Assyria, but Kittim is controversial and Eber is too. But all these names present several permutations and combinations of solutions. This website I found by a guy named Claude Mariottini says that various interpretations have been proposed to solve the difficulties offered by the text. Yes, various interpretations, but I'm going to give you the one that I think is the best. This is the idea that the ships from Kittim are the Philistines. Now, lots of people say that. Now, Aretini says this, quote, the Philistines is, quote, the most probable interpretation and one that has satisfied a number of commentators. Yes, a lot of commentators. In fact, if you read ancient Near East history, which I spent a lot of time listening to podcasts and reading, just trying to get oriented a little bit. Oh, it's always ships from Kittim. Kittim is Cyprus. The Philistines are the sea peoples. The sea peoples ravaged the coast of the Mediterranean in the 1200s B.C. Over and over and over again, they talk about the sea peoples. Of course, the evidence is slim, and they always speculate and all that. But it seems to be, like he says, a lot of commentators think these are the Philistines that come over from Cyprus. The Philistines are well identified as sea peoples who came from Cyprus, and the Philistines are also famous for their oppression of the Hebrews. So if you take Eber as Hebrews, you got ships from Kittim, the Philistines coming over to afflict the Hebrews. Well, that fits pretty good. That fits real good. And another thing that makes it likely that these ships from Kittim are the Philistines oppressing Israel is because the context of Balaam's prophecies are all about the enemies of Israel being destroyed. For example, he prophesied that the Moabites were going to have their heads crushed in verse 17. Then he says the Edomites are going to get wiped out in verse 18. The Amalekites are going to get wiped out in verse 20. And now if you say the Philistines are going to get wiped out, that fits the theme, does it not? If you say the ships from Kittim are Greeks or Romans, that doesn't fit the theme because the Israelites never wiped out the Greeks and Romans. Now, that takes care of the Philistines fighting the Hebrews, the Hebrews. What about Assyria? It's got the Philistines fighting the Assyrians. Well, actually, that area was controlled by the Neo-Assyrian Empire. Remember, they were advancing 900s, 800s, 700s B.C., and they ended up wiping out northern Israel in 722 B.C., and then right after that, they came down and almost knocked out Hezekiah. Hezekiah managed to fight them all, so the Assyrians, we know from biblical history, are fighting in that area. Now, this is what a website at AmazingBibleTimeline.com says about the Philistines and the Assyrians. Quote, the Philistines contended with Israel up until the time the Assyrians conquered the whole region during the 8th century B.C., when I just mentioned that to you. After the Assyrians had taken over the area, the Philistines were no longer relevant and were absorbed by other cultures. Well, the Assyrians were some bad dudes. They were the big boys on the block, and the Philistines didn't have a chance really against them in that area along the coast of Israel there. And so it makes sense that these Philistines would afflict Asher. In other words, they try to fight Assyria. Assyria wipes them out. Because it says they too will come to destruction. Assyria and the Philistines will come to destruction just like the Edomites and the Moabites and the Kenites. And the Edomites, they're going down too. So I think that's the best way to interpret that. Now, our last verse in this chapter, verse 25, says that Balaam arose and went back to his homeland. He's finished. He's not going to curse Israel. Balak went his way. He went back to his Moabite leaders, I'm sure, and said, well, we failed on that one. And we'll see what happens with the Moabites versus the Israelites in later chapters. But before I leave this chapter, I want to give you an interesting summary of the whole Balaam episode given by Adam Clark. And I want to point out to you, well, before I do that, let me point out to you that Balaam went his way. He was heading back to Pethor, his hometown, but he didn't make it. Because in Numbers 31:8, we read this. They, the Israelites, killed the kings of Midian. The Midianites, if you recall, they were in the area of the Moabites, and they allied themselves with the Moabites against the Israelites. And so the Israelites fought Midian as well as Moab. And it says, they killed the kings of Midian and some other people, the five kings of Midian. They also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. So Balaam didn't even make it out of the conflict. I don't know how that happened. He should have gotten back to Pethor, but he didn't. Now, I'm going to summarize all of this stuff with Balaam by Adam Clark's summary, which is very thorough. And he's very, very favorable to Balaam. And I'll give it to you just for thought. I think he's too favorable, in my humble opinion. Well, let's see what Clark says. Number one, it appears sufficiently evident from the preceding account that Balaam knew and worshiped the true God. Well, I don't know what you mean by worshiped. I don't think he gave his heart to God. I think he acknowledged that God had some true knowledge. So again, I think that's too lenient on Balaam. Clark's point number two. Balaam has been a true prophet and appears to have been in the habit of receiving oracles from God, no question. Clark's point number three. Balaam practiced some illicit branches of knowledge or was reputed by the Moabites as a sorcerer, probably because of the high reputation he had for wisdom. And we know that even in our own country in the 15th and 16th centuries, persons who excelled their contemporaries in wisdom were reputed as magicians. So now Clark is trying to say, he really wasn't a sorcerer, he was just a wise man. Oh, come on, Adam, please. Adam Clark is an Arminian. Arminians just can't bring, in general, just seem to be so easy on people. Verse 4. Balaam, this is Clark's, I'm sorry, not verse 4, Clark's point 4. That though Balaam was a believer in the true God, yet he was covetous. He loved the wages of unrighteousness. Well, again, he did. He was greedy for money, but he was a believer in the true God? Well, only in an intellectual sense. Verse 5. It does not appear that in the case before us, Balaam wished to curse Israel when he found they were servants of the true God. Well, that's true. But why is it true? Because he was afraid of God, not because he loved God, in my humble opinion. Verse 6. It is possible Balaam did not know that Israel was the servant of the true God. Balak told him that there was a numerous people come out of Egypt, and as marauders, wandering hordes, freebooters, etc., were frequent in those days. Balaam might take the Israelites at first for such spoilers, and the more readily go at Balak's request to consult God concerning them. So, and that might be true, actually. I'd give Clark that. Balak might not have realized who God's people were. He might have thought they were just a bunch of bums, a bunch of crooks, a bunch of pirates, land pirates. Clark's point number 7, that so conscientiously did Balaam act in the whole business that as soon as he found it displeased God, he cheerfully offered to return and did not advance till he had not only the permission but the authority of God to proceed. Well, when we went through that, it looked like he was trying to get God to change his mind constantly. He did offer to return, that's true. And he did not offer to come back until he had permission from God, that's true. But why? Because he was scared, I think. And he was constantly trying to get God to change his view, for God to change God's view. Clark's point number 8. That when Balaam came in view of the Israelite camp, he did not attempt to make use of any means of sorcery, evocation of spirits, necromantic spells, etc., to accomplish the wish of Balak. Well, that's true. He didn't use demon stuff. Got to hand that to him. Verse 9, Balaam sought to find out the will of the true God by using those means which God himself has prescribed, supplication and prayer, and the sacrifice of the clean beast. That's true. He was going at least externally to the outward forms of Yahweh worship. Clark's point number 9, Balaam did seek to find out the will of the true God. Well, I just read that one, excuse me. Adam Clark, point number 10, that though Balaam knew it would greatly displease Balak, yet Balaam most faithfully and firmly told Balak all that God said on every occasion. Okay, that's true. We'll give that to him. Adam Clark's point number 11, that notwithstanding Balaam's allowed covetous disposition, yet Balaam refused all promised honors and proffered rewards, even of the most extensive kind, to induce him to act in any respect contrary to the declared will of God. That's true. He did. He resisted the money. But I think it's because he was scared of God, not because he loved God. Adam Clark, point number 12. God on this occasion communicated to Balaam some of the most extraordinary prophetic influences ever conferred on man. And that's true, as we just saw. We go through those 7 prophecies. They were some really far-sighted prophecies. They all came to pass. Adam Clark, point number 13. That Balaam's prophecies are, upon the whole, clear and pointed, and have been fulfilled in the most remarkable manner, and furnish a very strong argument in proof of divine revelation. Got no problem there. Adam Clark, point number 14, that notwithstanding the wicked counsel given to the Midianites, the effects of which are mentioned in the following chapter, on which account Balaam probably lost his life, the badness of this man's character has been very far overrated, and that it does not appear that he was either a hypocrite, false prophet, or a sorcerer in the common acceptation of the term, and that he risked even life itself in following and fulfilling the will of the Lord. Man, he sounded like he's a saint. Well, we'll read some of these verses that don't make him sound like a saint in just a minute, right here under Adam Clark, point number 15. That though it is expressly asserted in Numbers 31:16 and Revelation 2:14 that Israel's committing whoredom with the daughters of Moab was brought about by the evil counsel given by Balaam to cast the stumbling block in their way. Ooh. Yet it does not appear from the text that he had those most criminal intentions which are generally attributed to him. For as we have already seen, so much good in this man's character, and that this and his love of money. And who thinks this is a sin? Oh, really? Love of money is not a sin? Adam Clark seems to not think so. And his love of money and all that stuff are almost the only blots. In other words, casting a stumbling block in front of the Israelites, as we're going to read here in just a minute, and his love of money are two minor things. That's no big deal. It most certainly be consistent with candor and charity to suggest a method of removing at least some part of this blame. Well, let's look at the verses that Clark is trying to poo-poo. Numbers 31:16. Yet they are the ones who, at Balaam's advice, incited the Israelites. This is the Moabites. Yet they, the Moabites, are the ones who, at Balaam's advice, incited the Israelites to unfaithfulness against the Lord in the Peor incident. We'll read about that in the next chapter. So that the plague came against the Lord's community. So this disastrous, idolatrous event that the Israelites got themselves into was at Balaam's advice, and Clark says, well, so what? Revelation 2:14. This is Jesus speaking, but I have a few things against you. You have some, I forgot which church that is. Let me check real quick. Pergamum. But I have a few things against you. This is to the church at Pergamum. You have some there who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to place a stumbling block in front of the Israelites, to eat meat sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality. So Balaam tells Balak, get those Israelites to sacrifice to idols and then have sex with our sexy, beautiful Moabite women. And that, of course, will lead them to more idolatry. And that's a minor thing? That's a minor thing, Mr. Clark? Please. Adam Clark, point number 16. I would therefore simply say that the counsel given by Balaam to Balak might have been to form alliances with his people, especially through the medium of matrimonial connections, and seeing they could not conquer them, to endeavor to make them their friends. Now, though this might not be designed by Balaam to bring them into a snare, yet it was a bad doctrine, as it led to the corruption of the holy seed into an unequal yoking with unbelievers, which, though even in a matrimonial way, is as contrary to sound policy as to the word of God. Well, so basically what Clark is trying to do here is saying, well, you know, Balaam did give him that advice, but he didn't mean it in a bad way. He didn't mean to have, say, commit sexual immorality. He meant for the Israelites to have matrimonial connections with the Moabites and to make them their friends. He wasn't asking them to go out there and commit adultery and to have immoral sex with the Moabites. Oh, jeez. Point number 17 from Adam Clark. It was the Moabite women, not Balaam, that called the people to the sacrifice of their gods. And it argued great degeneracy and iniquity in the hearts of the people on so slight an invitation to join so suddenly so impure a worship, and so speedily to cast off the whole form of godliness with every portion of the fear of the Almighty. Therefore, the high blame rests ultimately with themselves, with the Israelites. Well, sure, the Israelites were guilty, Adam, but that doesn't mean that Balaam was guiltless just because they were guilty. It's ridiculous. Besides, Numbers 31:16 or Revelation 2:14 puts the blame fairly where it belongs, right on Balaam's, right between Balaam's eyes. Ladies and gentlemen, with that little screed, I am now finished with Numbers chapter 24. This audio has been very, very long. But now we'll go to the next audio, which will probably be fairly short. It's got a great story, the zeal of Phinehas. Phinehas ends up taking a spear and stabbing an Israelite man and a Moabite woman in flagrante delicto. Boy, they were getting it on, and he put an end to that. Stuck them like a shish kebab. We'll see that in our next audio, Numbers chapter 25. I hope you stay tuned for that, and hope you enjoyed this one.